session number 12371, reel 7.
As I say, the Whirlwind was very manoeuvrable, and of course we did have the advantage of the two engines, which meant that if one was hit in one engine, one had some hope of getting home, which of course was denied to the single engine fighter squadrons, some of whom were doing similar types of operations against targets on the continent that we were. One small problem was that the Whirlwind didn't have a crossfeed between the tanks of both engines, and so if you had one engine knocked out, you couldn't use the fuel from that tank. The low level, most of the low level operations over the continent that we took part in were an operation known as Operation Rhubarb. Now, Operation Rhubarb was a general operation that was that applied to all fighter squadrons in the south of England. In other words, squadrons who could get to the continent. A list of targets that were suitable to be attacked by the sort of bombs we carried and the guns the fighters were equipped with was maintained, and this was added to or targets deleted if they were destroyed or lost their importance. And these target lists were passed round to squadron and wing leaders. Sometimes group would lay on an operation against one particular type of target. For instance, they might pass an instruction round to all fighter squadrons that for the time being we must concentrate on railways or headquarters or something like that. But usually it was left to the discretion of the squadron and wing leaders as to which targets they were going to attack, and invariably it was done on the basis that if they had any spare capacity from any other operations they might be taking part in, I mean in the case of a fighter squadron or fighter wing they might be carrying out a lot of sweeps, for example, fighter sweeps, which probably meant they didn't have any spare capacity for rhubarbs as well. But very often if the weather was too bad for sweeps they could send quite a lot of aircraft off on rhubarbs, because one of the rules as far as the rhubarb was concerned, bearing in mind that one was operating in pairs, sometimes four aircraft but usually pairs, that one clearly was likely to be vulnerable if one was attacked by superior forces, and so one was supposed not to operate unless the cloud base was 8/8 at no higher than 1,500 feet, the object of the exercise being that if you were attacked, you could then seek protection in cloud. So, as I say, very often, if these were the conditions, they may not be suitable for a fighter sweep, for instance, and so fighter squadrons would turn their attention to these rhubarb targets. Many of the squadrons used to fit bomb racks, the Spitfire squadrons, for instance, used to fit bomb racks and carry 250-pound bombs for particular rhubarb operations. Then when they came home, they'd take the bomb racks off again. As far as we were concerned, our bomb racks were permanently fitted, and we spent our whole time, as I say, tending to attack ground targets on the continent and coastal shipping targets, both by day and on moonlight nights. We couldn't operate on dark nights because we had no radar. but all our attacks were at low level, both by day and by night. At night time, when we were attacking shipping targets, and at daytime too, we were helped a great deal by the low-level radars, particularly the Dover radar. They could see the targets, because they could even see into France, but they could see the enemy target, and they would be able to see us as well, and they would give us vectors to get us in the right position to attack the target. This was very important at night, of course. It was pretty important during the daytime, because some of the attacks against the larger targets in daytime were against a ship possibly, shall we say, of 3,000 tons, 5,000 tons, which might be very heavily escorted both by E-boats, which were heavily armed, they were much bigger than our MTBs, and flak ships, and even sometimes they might even, if the target was a very important target, while they were trying to get it through the straits, it would often be covered by a fighter cover. And so if we went out to attack one of these targets, we had to take with us a squadron of fighters who would act as anti-flak, or it might even be a wing if the target was big enough. And sometimes even we'd have to take another squadron or wing of fighters as top cover to protect us from any fighters that the enemy might be using. And so sometimes the operations were quite large when we were setting out to attack one of these big shipping targets. The procedure was fairly straightforward. The leader of the whole operation was the Whirlwind Squadron Commander, or the Whirlwind Leader. And having arranged who was going to be our anti-flak, we would arrange a rendezvous with them, because from the moment we taxied out, there would be no RT at all. The radio silence would be maintained throughout the whole operation until the Whirlwind Leader gave the order to actually attack. And the way these operations would be conducted would be that the Whirlwinds would take off from Manston at a low level, and they rendezvous with the anti-flak Spitfire squadron, shall we say, at Dungeness or something like that, wherever, depends where the target was, but we'll assume the target is somewhere in the direction of Latouque. Rendezvous with the Spitfire anti-flak squadron, all at low level. They'd then set course. If it was necessary to have a top cover as well, this would have taken off from its airfield and possibly steered a course away from where the target was, so that it didn't give away that the target was about to be attacked. They would only then turn towards the target once they knew the attack was about to go in. Back to the Whirlwinds and the anti-flak Spitfires, they'd be going out, as I say, at low level, by that I mean 20 feet over the sea. As the target came into sight, the Whirlwind Leader would then, over the RT, to all and sundry, say, target ahead, buster. Top speed, in other words. The anti-flak Spitfires would then rocket up to about 1,000 feet and start attacking the E-boats and anti-flak and flak ships. If there was a top cover, they'd immediately turn toward the target to make sure that no fighters interfered. Meanwhile, the Whirlwinds would head for the target in pairs, the left-hand aircraft of the pair attacking the rear of the ship and the right-hand attacking the front of the ship. As they came to the ship, they'd fire their cannon to try and keep heads down on the target, the aircraft would release their bombs at the side of the ship and would pull up over the ship, the left-hand aircraft turning to port and the right-hand aircraft turning to starboard. One had to miss the masts and other bits and pieces, radar aerials and things were on top of the ship, and directly one got down the other side, one got back to sea level again and turned for home, weaving and jinking, because by this time one would be under fairly heavy fire, even though the Spitfires had been attacking the various E-boats and flagships. And then, of course, once the whirlwinds had withdrawn, the anti-flak aircraft would withdraw, and so would the top cover. And that was very much the sort of operation that took place when we were attacking a major shipping target. Otherwise, we used to send aircraft out in pairs or fours, usually without any form of anti-flak or escort, and they would pick up a target and attack it and get in and get out as quickly as possible, because directly the bombs started going off, any fighters that might have been around would immediately be alerted. So the speed of the whirlwind and the ability of the pilots to fly at really low level was very important on occasions like this. And when I say low level, I mean we used to fly so low that the spray used to be whirled up by the, or whipped up by the propellers of the aircraft very often. At night, if we were attacking a shipping target, we used to operate individually, obviously. One aircraft would go out, it would again operate with RT silence, it would go out at low level, it would be picked up by the by Swingate, the Dover CHEL station, and it would be vectored into the correct attacking position, making sure that it wasn't down moon where it could be seen, and then it would go in and drop its bombs. And if it didn't sink the target or badly damage it, then another aircraft would go out, and so it would go on. Sometimes these targets, if they were any size, would be escorted by E-boats at night, although by no means as many as during daylight, and they would sometimes cause a problem, because as you can well imagine, if you get a lot of tracer being fired at night, it can be quite blinding for somebody who's flying at very low level. As far as our attacks against continental targets at night in the whirlwind, and I'm not reiterating, this is on moonlight nights, because we needed the light to be able to navigate by and to be able to see our targets visually by. At night attacking targets on the continent, whereas in daytime when we crossed in to the continent on operations, we used to go in absolutely flat out, weaving and jinking, because directly we got anywhere near the coast we came under heavy ACAC fire. At night we were able to go out at low level and then climb up to about 1,000 feet just short of the coast, because a lot of the ACAC guns were operated visually. And then we were able to dive across the coast using our extra speed to help us get across the coast quickly. And then having got in, again at low level, but not quite so low obviously as during the day, it wasn't necessary, we'd pick up a master point from which we'd start doing our navigation to get us to the targets that we were looking for. Coming out, we would usually come straight out at low level, because if you started climbing up over the continent, you'd get picked up by searchlights very quickly, and if they coned you, it could be very unpleasant, because immediately it would be followed by some very accurate anti-aircraft fire. Any departure from the continental coast, be it by daylight or at night, was done by a lot of skidding and weaving and jinking until you got out of anti-aircraft fire range, although, funny enough, you weren't always out of range, because particularly if one was anywhere within range of the long-range guns that were surrounding places like Calais and Boulogne, they'd sometimes shoot at you with these, and you'd be flying along at 20 feet thinking you were miles out of range of any aircraft, when suddenly a great plume of water would go up with a great woof by the side of you, and they'd be shooting at you with these long-range guns. And we were frequently fired at by these guns, particularly when we were going into a target in daylight. So one knew very well that almost from the moment we left the English coast that we might be liable to suddenly find these great plumes of water shooting up around us. I don't recall myself on any operation I took part in anybody either being hit by one of these shells or even flying into the spray that was thrown up by them. I stayed with number 137 squadron until about January 1943. So I'd been with them now as a supernumerary squadron leader for nearly 5 months, and I was now, I think, qualified as an experienced fighter stroke fighter bomber pilot. But the CO of the squadron seemed to be going on forever, and so I was suddenly switched to the Americans, and I joined United States 8th Army Air Support Command as a fighter liaison officer. This was a slightly new experience because we found ourselves based at Sunning Hill Park near Ascot, and there all those things that we hadn't seen in our shops in England for quite some time were available to us through the American PX, which of course we were allowed to use. Moreover, if we wanted to go anywhere, we just ordered a car, an enormous American car, driven usually by a most beautiful girl driver, would arrive to take you wherever you wanted to go. But the more serious part of my role was to teach the Americans something about what it was like to operate as a fighter pilot, bearing in mind none of them had ever been on operations in their lives. Now, all the squadrons that came under this headquarters, which were now ranged on airfields such as Aldermaston and Greenham Common and Membury and the airfields along the Berkshire Downs, they had originally been equipped with Mustangs, but these aircraft had been taken away from them, I think, to support the torch operation, so they arrived in England without any aeroplanes. The RAF, out of the goodness of their hearts, gave them some Spitfires so that they got something to fly. Well, apart from the fact the Spitfires, most of which had come from the Polish squadrons, and therefore had been flown so hard that their wings were almost flapping, the Americans, of course, were unused to aeroplanes that had A, such a narrow undercarriage, and B, that didn't have tow brakes. They had not come across aeroplanes that had brakes on the control column as they did on the Spitfire. And so we had untold problems with people standing on their nose, swinging off the runway, and goodness knows what else. But eventually, I decided to take one or two of these chaps on a rhubarb. And I chose an area that I felt was moderately safe, inasmuch as it was an area which was well clear of the main German fighter bases. My whole object was not really to get them shot at, was more to get them used to being over enemy territory and knowing they were over enemy territory. I used to take them in fours, so there were four of us, two sections. And I impressed on them that under no circumstances were they to leave the formation. They were to operate entirely under my orders. And if they left the formation, they were not only making themselves vulnerable, but they were making the people they left vulnerable. Well, I think we did perhaps three sorties altogether, certainly no more. And I remember on one of them, we were flying along at about 1,000 feet, and suddenly one of these Americans saw a train, and before you could say "Jack Robinson," I suddenly found myself alone in the air. They'd all disappeared. I didn't relish staying with the Americans, really. It was a bit of a cushy sort of job, and I felt I wanted to get back to a squadron, and so I got on to the Air Ministry and said that I'd wanted to get back to a squadron, and next thing that happened was a signal arrived posting me to the Air Ministry, which absolutely horrified me. I went up and reported to the wing commander with whom I was supposed to be working, an ex-fighter chap called John Peel, and he said to me, "How does this appeal to you?" And I said, "It utterly appalls me." He said, "Why?" I said, "Because I don't want to sit in the Air Ministry." I said, "I want to go back to a squadron." A week later, I was posted to number 181 Typhoon Squadron, commanded by Dennis Crowley Milling, as a supernumerary squadron leader. We were just about to move down to Gravesend, and so now I was operating on Typhoons. We were involved quite a bit in the low-level patrols against German fighters that were attacking the coastal towns in the south. And in fact, this led to a serious shortage of Typhoons because the enormous effort that was being put into this particular type of operation, the Typhoon being the only thing, the only aircraft that was fast enough to catch the 190 particularly and the 109 at that level. The effort was so considerable that they were finding that the engines, the Sabre engines of the Typhoon, were requiring an overhaul after about 25 hours. And so the result was there was a great shortage of Sabre engines, which meant that the re-equipment of squadrons to the Typhoon had to be halted for a while. At this time, we had the Typhoon 1, which had the car-type doors on it. Instead of having a hood that you slid backwards and forwards, you had a couple of doors, rather like you have on a car. And the visibility out of the aeroplane was not wonderful. It was, of course, a heavy aeroplane. It was a big aeroplane. It was very fast. It was pretty manoeuvrable, and, of course, it had its four cannon. But two of the problems that we came across were, firstly, we had a spate of tails falling off, which killed the pilot every time. And the second thing was we suddenly started getting accumulations of carbon monoxide in the cockpit, and there were one or two mysterious accidents which were put down to this. And so from then onwards, on all Typhoons and subsequently when the Tempest came in, you had to turn on the oxygen before you started the engine, and you remained on oxygen until the engine was stopped after you finished your sortie. The other thing about the Typhoon was it was a very hot aeroplane, and I certainly often flew in a vest and underpants with my overalls over the top and nothing else. Number 181 Squadron then moved from Gravesend to Lasham, I think, or to another airfield, and they were replaced by 174 Squadron, also Typhoon Squadron, who had been with me as a Hurricane Bomber Squadron at Manston when I was in 137 Squadron, and I knew a lot of the people, including the Squadron Commander, McConnell. And so I said to Dennis, look, Dennis, do you mind if I switch over to 174 Squadron, as I know a lot of the chaps? And Dennis said, not at all. And so I switched to 174 Squadron, again as Supernumerary Squadron Leader. And I operated with them for a short time, and then the squadron commander of number 137 Squadron, the Whirlwind Squadron at Manston, became tour expired, and I was posted back to number 137 onto the Whirlwinds again as the squadron commander. The other operations, of which we carried out very few on the Whirlwind, was dive bombing. And it was not an aeroplane that was very suitable for this role because it picked up speed so quickly in the dive. But we did carry out two attacks that I was involved in. There may have been others that I was not aware of. It required us to climb to 12,000 feet with 500-pound bombs, two 500-pound bombs. We were escorted, of course, by a Spitfire squadron or wing. And we picked up such enormous amount of speed in the dive that we far exceeded the manufacturer's recommended speed for the safety of the airframe. But nobody's wings came off, and I don't recall anybody had any problems. But one certainly, it was not really an ideal aircraft for dive bombing. One reached its limiting speed far too quickly.